You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on November 26th, 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
There are productive ways of responding and expressing those frustrations, and there are destructive ways of responding. Burning buildings, torching cars, that's destructive, and there's no excuse for it.
President Barack Obama calls for calm, as he so often does, as demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri inspire protests across the United States. John Everard and Samira Shackle will be here to discuss that and the day's other stories, including further unrest in Hong Kong, Germany's plan for boardroom gender quotas, and the retirement of Cambodia's most famous elephant. We'll check in with our woman in Rio, who may struggle to be heard over the laughter attending the unveiling of the city's Olympic mascots, and we'll get a preview of Somerset House's new exhibition of the photography of Guy Bourdin.
He was really motivated by trying to produce impossible images. The kind of image that when you looked at it, the first thing that you thought was, oh my God, how was that made?
And we'll brace ourselves for the festive theatre season. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. But ahead of another action-packed hour, Paul Osborne has the world news.
There have been protests in a dozen US cities over the decision not to charge a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. For a second night, there was violence in Ferguson, where the shooting happened in August. But a heavy police and National Guard presence meant it was quieter than the previous night. The officer who shot Michael Brown, Darren Wilson, has said he has a clean conscience. Ronald Johnson speaks for the Missouri Highway Patrol.
If any of us knew last night was going to be what it was, if we had a crystal ball, we'd have probably done something different. But we could have never imagined that. And we reevaluate it, and I think we're there where we need to be, and we'll continue to get better at it. And I think now we all understand what we need to do to make this community safe, and I think we're all on the same page.
A campaign to immunize children in Pakistan against polio has been suspended after four health workers were shot dead. They're the latest of more than 60 people to have been killed during the immunization campaign over the last 2 years. Cases of polio are at a 15-year high in Pakistan, but the Taliban has claimed the program is a Western plot to allow spies into the country or to sterilize children. NATO's most senior military commander says Russian forces continue to provide the backbone of separatist rebels fighting in eastern Ukraine. General Philip Breedlove has been in talks with Ukraine's leaders in Kiev, warning Moscow's move to annex Crimea could allow Russian influence to extend across the Black Sea. Earlier, Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel accused Moscow of undermining international law and peace in Europe. Lithuania's defense minister, Juozas Olekas, says it's vital that Western nations continue to support Ukraine.
I've seen the injured and young man with amputation legs, the arms and injured and in other parts of the body. And I think that we should be more active to support them, including the discussion about the armaments and ammunition.
Algeria says it's killed a militant involved in the killing of a French hostage in the country in September. Erv Gourdel's abduction and murder was claimed by a group called the Caliphate Soldiers, which has allied itself with Islamic State militants. Officials say the militant was killed in a raid last month. In Hong Kong, police officers who were filmed beating a pro-democracy protester have been arrested on suspicion of assault. Earlier, police cleared demonstrators from another of the camps set up by the pro-democracy movement, prompting scuffles with hundreds of protesters. The European Commission has announced a new investment plan worth more than 300 billion euros. It's designed to kickstart growth and create up to 1 million jobs across the EU. But private firms will provide around 90% of the money. The President of the Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, says it could provide a huge boost for European economies.
Today, Europe is turning a page after years of fighting to restore our fiscal credibility. An ambitious yet realistic investment plan for Europe. Europe needs a kickstart, and today the Commission is applying the jump cables.
The vice president of Zimbabwe has been banned from the highest committee of the country's ruling party after being accused of plotting to replace the president. Robert Mugabe is 90 and has led Zimbabwe since 1980. He has previously said he has no intention of resigning, and Joyce Muchuru has denied a plan to succeed him. But analysts in Zimbabwe say her fall from grace is evidence that the country's politicians are jostling for a strong position in case there is a vacancy. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18:06 here in London, which is 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news, here we have John Everard, former British diplomat, and Samira Shackle, the journalist and commentator. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the United States, where protests in several cities have followed those in Ferguson, Missouri, about the decision of a grand jury not to indict a white police officer for shooting dead an unarmed black teenager in August. Here is some of what President Barack Obama had to say earlier.
Those who are prepared to work constructively, your president will work with you. And a lot of folks, I believe, in law enforcement, and a lot of folks in city halls and governor's offices across the country want to work with you as well. So as part of that, I've instructed Attorney General Eric Holder not just to investigate what happened in Ferguson, but also identify specific steps we can take together to set up a series of regional meetings focused on building trust in our communities. And next week, we'll bring together state and local officials and law enforcement and community leaders and faith leaders to start identifying very specific steps that we can take.
Ferguson itself is reportedly quieter today following the deployment of 2,200 troops from the Missouri National Guard. Protests elsewhere have been smallish and have resulted in minor incidences of violence. Samira, I'll ask you first. President Barack Obama talking there about very specific measures which would be taken without actually naming any of them. What have you made of the official response so far? I guess specifically about these protests. The protests earlier when Michael Brown was first shot were obviously more spontaneous. Everybody knew these ones were coming.
I think the official response has basically been quite a failure, really, because you have Barack Obama making that statement, but it's not really an acknowledgement of the hugely widely felt sentiment that exists two sets of laws, essentially, for people of different races. And I think that's not really quite been addressed. And I think it's unfortunate that protests have turned violent, but I think it's also quite inevitable, perhaps, when you have whole sections of the population who feel disenfranchised and who feel betrayed by the authorities, and who I think feel also that there's sort of very effective law enforcement measures in place to control looting, but not such effective enforcement measures in place to censure a policeman who shot an unarmed teenager.
John Everard, it's very difficult to find, and I've been looking, precise figures on how many American citizens are killed by their police every year, but the number that most people seem to settle on is an average of around 400. Without wishing to belittle any of those incidences, why do you think this particular one has become so resonant?
I think it's largely happenstance. I think, firstly, because this incident was allowed to brew up. I mean, the shooting took place in August, so emotions had been sort of simmering away under the surface for some time. I think the authorities, whatever the rights and wrongs of the case, handle the presentation badly. Bringing something like this out in a place like Ferguson, Missouri, at night really wasn't clever. I see that one US commentator said why they just hand out matches to everybody. It'd have been easier. And I think, too, two, the reaction of the family, who are, of course, there are distraught. I mean, any family would be to see their son shot like this. But their remarks and the campaign they've launched for what they see as justice for their son has been sustained. It has been articulate, and it's been very, very determined.
And Samira, you mentioned there the perception, and you're quite right that that perception exists. You don't need to spend long in the United States without running up against it, that perception that there are effectively two legal structures in place, and it's quite racially divided, as America is on all sorts of levels. But did you get the sense that before the grand jury announcement was made, people had already made up their minds? One of the things that has been lost in the trouble is that the grand jury was mixed race. It did sift through 1,000 pages of evidence and any number of evidence from witnesses. But I don't get the sense that anybody changed their minds as a result of that.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think that it's can't really be separated from its wider context. Whatever the fact of this individual case or this individual grand jury discussion, I think sometimes certain cases, for whatever reason, whether it's happenstance, whatever, as John said, certain cases become a flashpoint and a thing that triggers this sort of public discussion. You had sort of not quite on the same scale, but outrage over the killing of Trayvon Martin, the teenager. I think it was 2 years ago now. And so I think certain things like that. So whatever the individual mechanics of this case, I think it's seen within a context, and certainly to the protesters across the country, it's seen within a context where I think 21 times more black teenagers are killed every year than white teenagers. That's a really big statistic, and where as we've sort of both said, that big sections of the population feel that two different sets of law enforcement apply. So I think in a way it almost would have been, you've got this sort of federal civil rights inquiry happening, I think, a sort of broader look at the...
Some suggestion that a civil suit may be brought against the police officer,
but there's also
as well.
There's also a civil rights inquiry into Ferguson police, and I sort of feel like the police force in the US across different states would sort of needs that moment that we had in the UK with the McPherson report. Well, I mean, whatever the problems that still continue in the UK police force, at least you had that moment where we said, yes, there's institutional racism in the police, and it's sort of open looking at it. And I think, so whatever the mechanics of this individual decision, I think there's certainly a perception that it's a whitewash and that it would have been better for it to all be discussed in a trial of some sort of public discussion.
Of course, yes, there's a perception that it's a whitewash, and this has set a large part of America on fire. One of the tragedies, I think, of this case is that it's not at all clear what happened that night. And the grand jury, I've no idea how far their minds were set before they produced their verdict and how far they carefully weighed the evidence. But they did come out with a clear statement that a lot of the physical evidence contradicted witness statements. That's to say that some of the people who came forward and said that Michael Brown was walking away with his hands up at the time, many of whom since recanted, some of these people may simply have been lying. And I think it would add a further layer of tragedy if this whole eruption of frustration, of pent-up emotion, and of, as you say, a grievance that there seems to be a dual legal system in place, that all this is triggered by an incident where the rights and wrongs are, at this stage at least, far from clear.
And with inevitable, well, I mean, at the rate at which people are killed by American police and at the rate at which black people are killed by them as opposed to white people, we did also have the other ghastly happenstance on Sunday of a 12-year-old boy, Tamar Rice, being shot dead in Cleveland for carrying a toy gun, which the police mistook for a real one. This in a state, of course, which permits open carry weapons anyway.
That's right. I mean, I think, in many ways, was a much clearer case. It's one of life's mysteries that it wasn't that case that sparked the riots, but Michael Brown.
But I don't think it matters what the case is. That's the whole point, isn't it? It's the fact that it's years and decades of horrible injustice and police violence and oppression and brutality. So whatever it was that made this case be the case that triggered that, it's obviously touched a nerve, and I don't think it really matters. The fact is that discontent, that distress, and in most cases very, very justified discontent, I think, exists, is enough reason to have a very thorough federal look into it and as some sort of wide-scale reform.
Similar scenes moving along, though staged for different reasons, have been taking place in Hong Kong, where police have moved to clear a large, long-established protest site in Mong Kok. This was one of the encampments first built by pro-democracy demonstrators in September. More than 100 have been arrested in the last 48 hours, including Joshua Wong and Lester Shum, and 7 police officers detained over the beating of activist Ken Chang on October 15th. John, I want to ask you first of all about those latter bunches of arrested. 7 police officers detained for beating up an activist, a beating which was apparently filmed, which is one of those weapons that I guess activists do have against heavy-handed police now that they mightn't have had 10 or 20 years ago. Is it possible to imagine that happening in mainland China?
Dream on. This is one of the most intriguing parts of this whole situation, that although a few weeks ago people were very concerned that the Chinese would simply walk in and that Chinese rather than Hong Kong law would be applied, that has not happened. Hong Kong law has been maintained. Proper standards of evidence have also been maintained. And these police officers, who, as you say, were filmed committing a clear assault on Ken Sang, are going to be, they've been suspended and now face criminal proceedings. Beijing must be fuming. Here we are weeks on, the protests are still live, and not only are they still live, I mean, the main encampment in the financial district is still there, still blocking the main highway, but the police their reputation has been diminished, and the tactics that would in Beijing be utterly normal have led to the suspension of peace officers.
Samira, what have you made, or what do you make of the Hong Kong democracy protest at this stage? Because it has been extraordinarily protracted and determined and courageous up against an absolutely vast and clearly quite ruthless foe. What do you think's kept them going this long?
I think that at the beginning there was certainly this huge momentum that I think was probably unexpected even by some of the protesters, the fact that so many people were turning out in the streets for the marches in the early days of it. I think that's now a little bit more complicated. It seems I was just reading today that there were that various polls, whereas before sort of big segment of the population in Hong Kong supported the movement, that now it's something like 80% don't want them to continue.
People just want to go back to work.
Yeah, and I think it's a business-minded place, certainly, and I think that the effect on businesses is probably turning some people against it. And I think also within the movement, there seems to be some splits. There's people who want to take further action and sort of carry on this civil disobedience, push it further, and others who don't really want to. So I think that those internal splits and the sort of shifting public opinion in the population more generally is probably sort of contributing to lowering momentum.
I think that, yes, that you always get splits in movements of this kind. The support levels you just quoted, I think, were out before these police officers were suspended and condemned. And I think we have to see what effect this has on public opinion. Mm. Earlier in the series of protests where police officers were found to have misbehaved, support for protesters soared, and I think we might see the same again. Worth mentioning that just to add to China's headaches, while all this is going on, Taiwan goes to the polls on Saturday. For local and mayoral governments across the, do we call the province or the country, whichever, with lots and lots of Chinese tourists. So at the same time as the Chinese are grinding their teeth watching this exercise in popular democracy in Hong Kong, they've got lots of their own citizens in Taiwan doubtless watching the elections and thinking, what a good idea, why can't we do this at home?
Samira, do you get the impression that the Hong Kong protests, and as we said, determined and long-running though they have been, have they actually accomplished anything?
I think it's difficult to say. I think the fact that they've set their bar very high, I mean, they want full democracy in Hong Kong, that's not something realistically that the government in China is going to give because of the kind of precedent it would set. So I think that makes it quite a difficult sort of barometer against which to judge their success. I think that, popular protest in Hong Kong has, I think, quite an important role, I think, probably to the psychology of the population. It's a sort of distinguishing feature from mainland China that they can have these protests and so on. And I think that opening that sort of discussion and making that kind of a statement about what they can do is good. But I think that ultimate goal is a bit of a... It's very ambitious. It's not very realistic, I don't think, unfortunately.
Ambitious is a pleasantly understated way of putting it in this particular case. John, just a final brief thought on this. Do you think they, if the Hong Kong protests were to end tomorrow, would they actually be able to say we have achieved something here?
If they ended tomorrow, probably not. I think what they might well be able to achieve is more constructive talks with the Hong Kong government and some kind of tweaking of the electoral law. That might still be within their grasp.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with John Everard and Samira Shackle. When we return, we'll be looking at Germany's new gender quota for its boardrooms and a retiring elephant.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are John Everard and Samira Shackle. It's 21 minutes past the hour. Now, from 2016, Germany's biggest corporations will have to ensure that 30% of the chairs in their boardrooms are occupied by women, as against the 17.4% that the free market has thus far furnished. Companies which fail to implement the quota will have to leave positions vacant. Germany is not the first European country to pass such a law. Italy, the Netherlands and Norway have all done so, or similar. But it is the most economically important. There's almost no way to ask questions about this as a white guy and sound good doing it. Samira, is this necessary, do you think?
Yeah, I do actually believe in these sorts of positive discrimination measures. I think they're a really important short-term way of changing the culture, and that's what Angela Merkel said about
exactly
it.
I mean, she had
originally opposed these measures, and then said it's I think something very similar to that, that's a way to force the culture change. And I think you don't really need to look much further than our own parliament, I think, to see the effect of that. If you look at the three main parties, the Conservatives, Labour and the Lib Dems, the Lib Dems have never had all female lists because they think it's illiberal to have that sort of positive discrimination, and they've got a sort of tiny, tiny percentage of female MPs as a result, whereas the other parties have introduced those lists and you are gradually improving female representation. I don't think it's a long-term thing necessarily. You'd hope that once you've had those measures in place for a while in politics, in business, in whatever field it is, that you would no longer need them. But I think certainly to make that change and make it the norm that women or minorities or whatever it is specifically that you're introducing those measures for, that becomes the norm, that they take up a certain amount of those positions.
Germany's own parliament is 37% female. Its cabinet 40% female, including the chancellor. John, as Samira pointed out, Angela Merkel was initially against it and appears to have changed her mind. Do you get the impression that that's a genuine conviction shift, or is this just politically expedient to go along with it?
I suspect the latter, to be honest. Angela Merkel, when she said no to this measure, was articulate and convincing. Now she said yes, she's neither of those things. And can I also say that we referred just now to other countries that have passed similar laws. The experience of implementation has not been happy. That if you try to create vacancies effectively for women at board level, two things happen. Firstly, nobody quite knows whether a woman who gets that job got it because she was the best person for the job or just because she was a woman. And that eats away at the women concerned as well as annoying the men. Second is, if you try to transfer executives across from one company to another, you get a discount on women because women are, in that kind of structure, are regarded as quite possibly promoted for all the wrong reasons. And they struggle much harder to shift companies than men do. I think positive action to encourage greater representation of women at senior levels, yes. This probably isn't the way to do it. It's been tried before and hasn't worked well.
I mean, Samira, Germany, like most modern countries, has has laws against gender discrimination, and quite rightly so. I think you would struggle to find a single sane person who objected to that. Isn't that enough just to say that you may not discriminate on the grounds of gender?
Well, I don't think it is, really. If you look in practice at the fact that women are underrepresented at those levels, and whatever the teething problems that John mentions, I think that those are the kinds of things that can be ironed out with time. It's about changing a culture. It's about you're not aiming to keep these quotas in place forever. You're aiming for a situation where you don't need quotas because there's enough women at that level already, and it's not a sort of culturally very masculine thing to be doing. So I don't think that gender discrimination laws alone are enough. No, if you've had those laws in place for many decades, as we have and as Germany has, then and that culture isn't changing, then I don't think there's anything bad at all about sort of giving an extra little push to force that culture to change. Because there's sort of uncountable examples all over the world of cases where you haven't taken any of those measures at all and nothing changes at all.
Yes, I don't think these are teething problems. I think these are structural problems with this approach. I mean, one thing, if we have learned anything from decades of trying to rectify gender balances at senior levels in government, in companies, is that if you don't go at the top, what you do is you try to rectify the gender balance at the point of recruitment into the organisation. And that has turned out to be a much more successful approach than what Angela Merkel is trying to do.
But that's not strictly true, is it? Because, I mean, you have... I know more about the statistics, sorry, in the UK than in Germany, but you have women outnumbering men at universities, you have women actually at graduate level earning more than men do, and yet you have pretty much no women at the top levels of anything. And that's, I think, that's why you need to address where that gap is happening. So actually, I completely agree that it's very important to be looking at the bottom levels, but I don't think it's enough. It's not enough to say that's it, because something happens. It's usually around the time when women have children, I think, but something happens, then that's why you don't have women at the top levels of anything, really, as a majority in the vast majority of industries and politics and business sectors.
But surely isn't the answer to look at why it is that women within organisations are not reaching the very top and to address those problems rather than try to create quotas?
Yeah, I think it's a case of doing both. I don't think it's sensible to introduce quotas, but Germany already has certain measures in place to start to address those other things. For instance, you can, to my knowledge, you can split maternity and paternity care can be split equally between the mother and father in Germany, which isn't something we have here, where men get much less time off work. So theoretically, a woman of childbearing age is no less employable than a man of childbearing age because that time can be split equally. So it's those kinds of measures in conjunction with quotas at the top that will address the problem.
OK, well, we shall head finally to Phnom Penh, whose streets are about to become elephant-free. The city's last working elephant has officially retired after more than three decades of carting tourists around the Wat Phnom Temple. The 54-year-old elephant, Sambo, which either means something different in Cambodia or times have changed for the better there since the early 1960s as well, will spend her dotage at an ecotourism park in the country. John, you brought this story to our attention, the retirement of Sambo the elephant. It's been a huge deal in Phnom Penh. There was an official ceremony. She was blessed by monks, etc., etc. Why has this been such a thing?
Because she's a heffalump, and we all love heffalumps. I mean, let's just go for the R factor, shall we? Let's not be rational about this. And because she's, after all, a very famous one. A lot of people, anybody who's been to Phnom Penh, has actually seen Sambo wandering around. Also, this is a story with a happy ending. She gets a decent retirement. She gets a wonderful send-off, as you say, lots of Buddhist priests and a fine last meal, and taken off to a nice elephant sanctuary in the jungle somewhere. I hope she has a happy retirement.
As I'm sure do we all. The retirement has been made possible by not least by a crowdfunded international donation. Samira, do you share John's soppiness about the elephant?
Oh, it's nice. I always wonder, when you have animals that have been so domesticated and kept in captivity for years and years, I always wonder if maybe they'd be a bit scared and lost going back to the wild, but maybe I'm just projecting onto them.
No, they have yeah. looked into this. Apparently her retirement will be very carefully managed because just as a human being becomes somewhat institutionalised in the workplace, there are fears that she may be as well. I don't know, looking at it widely in terms of sort of the streetscapes of Asian cities, John, where you do occasionally run up against elephants. In Bangkok, you can still see elephants meandering around downtown, which is deeply peculiar. Do you think maybe this is a hopeful step away from that being a sort of thing that actually happens?
Well, yes, I think it is. Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, that, as you said when you introduced the subject, is going to be elephant-free from now on. I mean, I suppose eventually Bangkok will go through the same process. Let's see.
We will have to leave it there. John Everard and Samira Shackle, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Still plenty to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be checking in with our woman in Rio and on Somerset House's new Guy Baudin exhibition and on the festive theatre openings. But before we get started on all of that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
There have been protests in a dozen US cities over the decision not to charge a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. For a second night, there was violence in Ferguson, where the shooting happened in August, but a heavy police and National Guard presence meant it was quieter there than the previous night. A campaign to immunise children in Pakistan against polio has been suspended after four health workers were shot dead. They are the latest of more than 60 people to have been killed during the immunisation campaign over the last 2 years. The Taliban says it's a Western plot to allow spies into the country. NATO's most senior military commander says Russian forces are still providing the backbone of the separatist rebels fighting in eastern Ukraine. General Philip Breedlove's been in Kiev for talks with Ukraine's leaders, warning that Moscow's move to annex Crimea could allow Russian influence to extend across the Black Sea. And in Hong Kong, seven police officers who were filmed beating a pro-democracy protester have been arrested on suspicion of assault. Earlier, police cleared demonstrators from another of the camps set up by the pro-democracy movement, prompting scuffles with hundreds of protesters. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. It is 21:32 in Moscow. That's 18:32 in London, 14:32, I think I'm right in saying, in Rio. And that's where we're going right now to talk to our correspondent there, Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, welcome to the programme. We were talking at the top of the show about the riots in Ferguson, Missouri, and protests elsewhere in the United States, which are dominating headlines around the world. How is that story playing in Brazil?
Yes, well, it definitely is getting some media attention down here in Brazil, as it is all over the world, as you just mentioned. But there's a major difference between these incidents in the United States and the incidents that happened in Brazil, because the fact of the matter is that there are Michael Brown shootings nearly every day in Brazil.
And, I mean, do they happen so often that people are past getting outraged by them?
Yes, definitely. It's just to kind of give you a few statistics, the Brazilian police on average actually kill six people a day here, and the vast majority of them are young black men from poor neighborhoods. So just to give you a few figures on that, between 2009 and 2013, the Brazilian police killed more people, about 11,197 people, and that figure is higher than the U.S. police killed in 30 years. In 30 years, the American police killed just over 11,000 people. So just to kind of give you the idea is that there were some reactions when there was a dancer for a popular samba show called Esquenta a few months ago, where he was shot by the police in a favela here in Rio de Janeiro. And there were some protests, but it just pales in comparison to what's going on in the United States, just the fact that people are so used to it that they've almost become numb, sadly.
Sheena, that figure you quote is mildly incredible, that Brazilian police killed, it adds up to 11,000 people killed in 4 years between 2009 and 2013. There are actual wars occurring in the world which don't account for that many fatalities.
Yes, definitely. Well, actually, several NGOs have estimated that about 2,000 people die at the hands, or rather the guns, of Brazilian police every year. And you certainly don't see that happening on a larger scale. You don't get the media attention that you're getting with this Michael Brown shooting. Of course, all these type of police shootings are tragic, but I think what we see from this incident is rather the overexposure that the media puts on events that happen in the United States versus the lack of exposure of these type of events that happen in Latin America.
Well, there's been one case recently, I understand, where some restitution has been wrought by the family of a victim against the police.
Yes. So about a year and a half ago, it happened on July 14, 2013, there was a man named Amarildo, and he basically was kidnapped by military police in Brazil's biggest favela called Rocinha, and he has basically not been seen since. Since then, several of the police commanders from the UPP, the Unified Pacified Police Division, which is designed to be set up in these favelas to protect the people in the favelas, had essentially kidnapped him, tortured him, and killed him. His body has never been found, but finally today, or yesterday rather, a court ruling ruled that the widow of Amarildo would have to receive a monthly minimum wage salary from the government, which is about $300, along with six other people from the family. She's also going to be getting psychological treatment for her grievances. However, I think it just also highlights how much longer the justice system takes here in Brazil, because this disappearance did happen a year and a half ago. And there was quite a bit of uproar when it did happen. But again, the media attention was nothing in comparison to the Michael Brown media attention.
I mean, is this particular case, is it likely to open up the police to more cases from the families of victims?
It could be something that will likely open up more cases. But I think with this Amarildo, the reason why it brought so much attention was because it wasn't just one police officer, it was several police officers, namely the captain of the UPP from Rocinha, that had kidnapped him. So it was several police officers involved, and it was clearly more well thought out, and it wasn't just a gunshot, it was actually being tortured. And he has since disappeared, and he's probably somewhere in the Tijuca rainforest here in Rio de Janeiro, and he hasn't been found, and who knows if he ever will be.
Well, we need to move along finally to an item we discussed on this program earlier in the week, which was the unveiling of the mascots for Rio, rather, 2016. Not sure myself why we need to see these 18 months before the Olympic flame is lit, but anyway, there they are. They struck me as almost entirely ridiculous. How have they gone over in Brazil?
Well, it's been rather funny because there's been non-stop social media attention around this, because they are quite funny and they aren't really anything in particular. So one is a yellow feline-like character, which is supposed to be a fusion of all the wildlife that we have here in Brazil. And the other one basically is this bluey-green tree-like creature, which is also supposed to be a fusion of all the great plantation that we have here in Brazil. And the reason why they are showing them 18 months before the Olympics is because they're looking to basically get money. They're spending about $20 billion, a mixture of public and private money, to prepare all this. And basically, they want to generate a fair amount of money from the marketing of these mascots, and they're going to have these mascots touring around. So it should be interesting what comes out of that.
Do people actually like them, though, or are people just mocking them? I mean, because we did an item on them earlier in the week, I actually looked up the London ones from only 2 years ago and realised I'd entirely forgotten them. They were those weird things that sort of looked like Teletubbies as reimagined by Stanley Kubrick.
Well, they haven't gotten quite a funny reaction. So the tree-like one people are joking that he looks like David Luiz or Anderson Barrejão, which they are a Brazilian athlete. So David Luiz is a football player and Anderson Barrejão is a basketball player in the NBA because they both have very cool for the amazing pros. And the yellow feline-like one is just basically more joking that it's Hello Kitty having an identity crisis. And then the other joke that a lot of people are making, which is quite funny as I find, is the fact that the names haven't been chosen yet and that the public does get to vote on what their names are. And there are three choices of the names. But one of the choices that a lot of people have created on their own is Propina e Arrastão, which in English, that would translate to that their names should be bribe and armed robbery.
Sheena Rossiter in Rio, thank you as ever for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's just gone 18:41 here in London, where this week those with a passion for fashion photography have a treat awaiting them. Somerset House is holding the largest ever exhibition of the work of the legendary Guy Bourdin. The French photographer, a protégé of Man Ray, dominated the pages of French Vogue in the 1970s and 80s with his surreal plays on staged glamour. Earlier today, Monocle's David Pleasant went to Somerset House, easy for me to say, to meet the exhibition's curators, one of which, Alastair O'Neill, began by introducing Bourdin's work.
We're standing in a room that has four projected films, moving images from Guy Bourdin. This is somewhat exceptional in the show, but maybe just use this as an introduction to his work and maybe his impact on fashion photography.
Guy Bourdin was one of the great fashion photographers of the 1970s, and really in that period his work was really celebrated alongside that of Helmut Newton's in the pages of Paris Vogue. People talk very affectionately and very fondly of looking forward to buying the edition of that particular title in order to see what they were up to. Newton's work was classically black and white, whereas Bourdin's was candy coloured. It was vividly in colour, and I think people really responded to that because it wasn't what you were really expecting from a high-end fashion title at that point in time.
And there's that kind of extraordinary level of imagination. We were just in one room earlier and you were describing the spider series of leg portraits. Maybe tell us about that. And he seemed to be obsessed about capturing one particular image.
Yeah, he was really motivated by trying to produce impossible images. The kind of image that when you looked at it, the first thing that you thought was, oh my God, how was that made? There's a particular shot that he was really, really interested in, returned to it time after time, which he called the spider's leg shot, where he would place three models, one on top of the other, actually using a supporting scaffolding structure, and then would photograph them so that their legs, when splayed out, looked like those of a spider's. And he made it for a Charles Jourdain campaign in 77, but returned to it 3 years later, and we have evidence of that shoot and how it was put together. And it's really, really startling, because I think those kinds of images are very easy to produce now in our digital age of photography via Photoshop or other kinds of digital alteration packages. But back then, it was much more analog and it was much more rudimentary. But I think because of that, the kinds of images that Bourdin was able to produce, they really kind of transcend what we can produce in our digital age. People are still fascinated by that. They have a kind of aura about them that we seem unable to kind of repeat. And I think that's why people continue to be fascinated by Bourdain.
My name is Shelley Wertheim. I'm co-curating the exhibition. In fact, for the last 10 years, I've been researching and working with the estate and with Samuel Bourdain, so I became the curator of the estate.
And maybe talk about the significance of this exhibition for your work, for the research and academia of Guy Bourdain.
It's the first time that we were able to put together capsules of a body of work that we developed through the years. It was either a book or an exhibition on its own, or the two together. Like A Message for You started as a book. We did an exhibition that toured, and we did the second publication just recently.
A little bit earlier, you were speaking about your work researching Guy Bourdain. What was your approach? You mentioned that you tried in a way to meet people who had worked with him and so on, but that didn't really work. What did you revert to?
The thing was, I was talking to Samuel, and from an early stage, I realized that his contribution and his commitment and passion to carry the legacy of his father is so deep and so serious that I want to have a serious dialogue. And when I say, listen, this is the list of people I would like to meet, just to have an insight of them today, looking in retrospect about the work, he said, you don't need to talk to people who worked with him for the moment. What you have to do is just study the images.
What kind of impact do you think Guy Bourdain has? I mean, it's very relevant, and perhaps it's almost strange to talk about him kind of as history. Yeah. Is that what you find? I mean, what do people come to you seeking inspiration? What do people tell you about their perception of him?
Most of the people, what they see is the timeless qualities, the modernity. I mean, when you look at it, you cannot imagine these colors were done pre-digital era. You see the composition, they are striking. You see iconography, you see signature, you see deeper layers of the work. When you look, you find more. You look further, you find things you didn't see before. This is something of artistic level. It's not just posing a beautiful model and take shots. You know, sometimes the set, to build the set with him took 40 hours in order to get it right as he envisioned it.
So, Alistair, we are looking at, there's a magazine spread in this cabinet in front of us. Maybe explain that relationship that we were talking about between the magazine and Guy Bourdain's work.
It's usually the case that when a photographer is commissioned by a magazine to produce some editorial, they'll take their contact sheet or their range of images along to the magazine and they'll highlight their selection, which is then handed over to the art director and the editor, and they are then responsible for translating that into double page spread layouts of image and text combinations, which produce in some of the magazine. Now, Bourdain was really unusual in his time because he wasn't just content with handing over a selection of images. He only ever provided one image, and that was the final choice. There was, and he was non-negotiable on that.
And I mean, in terms of kind of the impact that those shoots had on fashion photography and fashion publications, does it still resonate? Do you feel that there's a lot of links to Guy Bourdain's work still today?
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, I think he's one of the few 20th century fashion photographers whose work continues to be referenced by a younger generation of creatives working today. Normally, when you're doing this kind of show, you're trying to resurrect the career of the creative, but we don't have to worry about that because interest in Bourdain's work continues to grow. I think, in part, it's to do with our digital image culture and how we consume images now and how they circulate. And I think that's why Bourdain's work continues to resonate, because yes, it was produced in an analog age, but it's very fit for purpose for our digital one.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant speaking to Alistair O'Neill and Shelley Wertheim, curators of Guy Bourdain Image Maker, an exhibition at Somerset House in London running until March 2015. It's time now for a bit of music. On the theme established by the previous item, this is Liquid Programming. This is Pictures of You by The Cure. That was The Cure with Pictures of You. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And as we come to the end of the programme, it is time for our daily arts review. Today, once again, we're talking theatre with Louise Levine, journalist and critic with the Financial Times. Louise, you've brought in a very, very long list of theatrical stuff, much of it to do with Christmas, which is... There's still another month, isn't there?
Yes, well, we are spoilt for choice. And
yeah.
The entire schedules of all the ballet companies, all the dance companies are dominated by family-friendly stuff. Well, it depends on your family. It depends how friendly it is.
If only you knew my family.
Yeah. Well,
the chances of us convening a sort of family outing to go to some sort of festive-themed theatrical production, I'm not sure if I can think of literally anything less likely that could happen.
Well, why should there be the one thing that everyone's going to like? I mean, it's insane. Someone is going to be asleep, come what may. The important thing is to prepare, is to pick your show with care.
Or just drink heavily.
Well, I will come to that. But you've got to pick the right show. And the key thing is length.
Okay.
You decide what the pain threshold of the child in question, or indeed the adult in question, is going to be. And you mustn't be over ambitious because, they won't like it. They'll complain. With small children, make sure they know the story. If you can, play them the music, kind of show them a bit of the video or show them something on YouTube so they're half ready for it, and then wheel them off to whatever it is. Well, we've got Alice in Wonderland at the Royal Ballet.
A hardy perennial.
It's selling very, very well, and it's 2 hours and 55 minutes. Now, I think that's too long. I happen to know it is too long.
I think it's about 2 hours and 53 minutes too long.
Well, it's very long indeed. It's very expensive, obviously. The Opera House is a beautiful theatre, but it has some very tricky sight lines. I would be in two minds of launching a child who wasn't already mad about the ballet on something on such a big investment.
It's pretty hardcore, is what you're saying.
16th of December, you could see it in your local cinema, which would probably be a much better bet, much more fidget-proof. But at the same time, it is a big event if you take the children to the Opera House and you get more preparation. The campaign, you'll need a tiara, possibly a little lighting up wand, a personal supply of sweets and a little juicy drink because, the expense of the ticket is nothing as to the expense of all the ice creams you're going to have to buy. And then a Calpol, probably, a hip flask for you. And
You're making. I think you take less things if you're trying to climb Everest. Have you got anything you can recommend that's slightly less of an ordeal?
Well, I mean, it is a beautiful piece. I mean, I'm not being rude about it, but I would think Wind in the Willows, which is a very nice production, back for the umpteenth time, now in a little West End theatre, the Vaudeville Theatre. It's a familiar story. Everybody loves it. It's been retold by Andrew Motion, who you may remember was the poet laureate for a while. It's very beautifully danced. It's very creatively staged. Quite a lot of unexpected things turning into bits of scenery. And there's some snow. There's a motor car. And there's Alan Titchmarsh, who was a gardening presenter on British television and then became an all-round personality and is kind of bubbling under as national treasure. He's not dancing, sadly, but he's going to be doing the narration. And it is a lovely piece, and I can recommend it. I've seen children enjoy it. Unlike, in my experience, The Snowman, which is...
Oh, come on, really? See, I was a big fan as a kid, especially of Fungus the Bogeyman. But I also like Raymond Briggs's Foul-Tempered Santa Claus.
No, Fungus the Bogeyman, the ballet. Now you're talking. No, this is The Snowman.
Has no one ever done that?
Not yet. It's got to happen, hasn't it?
Man, that's my project for the Christmas holidays.
Well, the marketing alone. All that gunge. Anyway, The Snowman. It ought to be nice, oughtn't it? There's a big flying furry snowman. We're walking in the air. And it's snows, obviously. My children when they were the target age. I think one of them was four, one of them was six. And they took one look at it, got onto the floor and curled up and went to sleep. Which is not something you can normally get children to do.
Everyone's a critic.
So I would, yes, well, you mustn't be too ambitious. Another thing I really recommend is going to see The Nutcracker, which is, lovely music, great story. And it's on at the Coliseum with the English National Ballet. The trick with smaller children, take them to the first half, get Granny brought in for the second half, and it it solves everything, because the first half has the fighting rats, it has the growing Christmas tree, it has all the tin soldiers, everything happens, it seems like a happy ending, and then you've got a whole second act of national dances and tutus, which actually they're bored stiff. So I've done that and it works. So
why not just have everybody leave at the interval?
No, no, Granny will love it.
Really?
Wheel her out of the pub, in for the second act.
and wheel yourself into the pub, presumably.
Well, this is something you have to toss coins for or decide, because some husbands I know don't like. I mean, I had the wrong children, you know. I mean, a ballet critic, I go all the time. You know, people feed their children culture like sort of Strasbourg geese or something. But sometimes it works. You know, my mother took me to see Fontaine and Nureyev, and now look, you know.
Are there any other things you would recommend? Edward Scissorhands at Sadler's Wells.
That's good for the more...
Regrettably briefly.
Yeah, well, that's for the sort of more jaded, slightly older child. It sticks pretty closely to the film. It's got a very jazzy set. The music is pretty much like the film. I think it will give little children nightmares, I've always thought. You know, there he is, creepy, all those scissors in his hands. But it's a good show, and the Wells is a handy theatre if you live north of the river.
Louise Levine, journalist and critic with the FT, thank you as ever. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks to our earlier guests, Samira Shackle and John Everard. Today's show was produced by Emily Elias, researched by David Pleasant. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Up after the headlines, we have The Entrepreneurs. At 2200, The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.